Microsoft is facing criticism for a new app it has patented for GPS services. It has been dubbed the Avoid Ghetto feature. The technology is meant for pedestrians to help them avoid bad weather, difficult terrain, and what the patent describes as an unsafe neighborhood. As we hear from NPR's Allison Keyes, critics consider the feature nothing short of racist, while others insist it's simply the next step in GPS technology.
Let's be clear, the word ghetto doesn't appear anywhere in the patent. It's called pedestrian route production. Microsoft declined any comment. The technology in the patent will take information from maps, weather information, crime statistics, and demographics, then create directions, quote, taking the user through neighborhoods with violent crime statistics below a certain threshold. But a slew of headlines included the incendiary Avoid Ghetto nickname and generated some outrage.
I was pretty appalled.
Sarah Chin is author of Technology and the Logic of American Racism and an English professor at Hunter College. Chin says she understands why people might want such a GPS feature so they'd feel safe, but she says it reinforces assumptions about violent crime that aren't true. Chin says the nickname the patent has picked up and the news coverage of the technology illustrate the assumption that it will steer you away from neighborhoods where blacks and Latinos live because those are bad neighborhoods.
Even that immediate association is itself a symptom of the problem.
Chin says that storyline is so embedded in American society that people make what she calls that jump without even having to explain it.
Which is to say, we as white middle-class readers will immediately understand, you know, what this is all about.
Chin says we need to be able to distinguish between our prejudices and our assumptions and what's actually true. Though FBI crime stats for 2010 show that whites were arrested more often for violent crimes than any other race, Chin says,
in much of dominant American culture, there's an assumption that criminality and being poor and not white go hand in hand.
On the internet, there have been bitter battles, with written comments urging people to, quote, just stay out of black and Hispanic neighborhoods, or others describing as racist people who, quote, naturally associate avoiding crime with avoiding blacks. Of course, some folk, including Loop21.com editor Maurice Garland, poked a little fun at the controversy.
I mentioned Flint, Michigan.
Garland posted a piece on the African-American website listing places he felt would likely show up as unsafe on the software. Flint had the highest crime rate in current city crime rankings by the CQ Press.
I wouldn't be surprised if the entire city of Flint got a big red dot on the Avoid Ghetto application.
Garland says many of those offended by his posting about the technology were people of color, but he personally thinks the feature is more classist than racist.
I don't think anybody from any particular race was just being singled out. I mean, because they are using crime data to come up with these figures. So, I mean, you know, if you don't want to end up in those places, I mean, I don't see anything wrong with somebody trying to help you out.
I think it's something that the users of the technology have been asking for some time.
Industry analyst Rob Enderle says the GPS feature in the patent has nothing to do with race or income. He says it's about technology doing for us what it's supposed to be doing.
It's part of an overall effort to make navigation systems more intelligent so they keep you out of danger, whether you're driving or you're on foot.
In England 2 years ago, Jeff Gilfelt created a similar app that also uses government data. He says what's important is how software is developed and the quality of data it uses.
If it's taking data about, you know, incidents of crime that, you know, directly impact public safety, there should be no racial or economic or class bias there.
Gilfelt says his app didn't generate the level of controversy the Microsoft patent has. But there is an app that was created as an answer to his. It's called the Awesome Meter, and its description says it gives hope and security rather than spreading fear and distrust. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
Our program is directed by Monica Evstatieva, edited by Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. We had engineering support from Melissa Markey.
Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Graham Smith, Franklin Cater, Janae West, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Viad Lay, Jennifer Longmire Wright, and Rhonda Ray.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Apple today launched a big initiative to update an old standby, the school textbook. In a splashy announcement, the company released new tools to help publishers create digital content for students. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, Apple is trying to capitalize on enthusiasm for the iPad in schools and colleges.
Rather than staging this launch in Silicon Valley, Apple chose New York City, home to the publishing industry. Apple's Phil Schiller paid tribute to the school textbooks that millions of students have schlepped to school and to college. But he said they are obsolete.
If you're a school district that's had your budget has been squeezed and you've had to make them last 5 or 6 years and hand them from child to child, they get dog-eared and written in and worn. They're just not the ideal modern teaching tool.
If you've heard all this before, it's because publishers have been talking about digitizing cumbersome textbooks for years. But Apple says the iPad has changed the equation. The company says there are already 1.5 million iPads in educational settings. That makes this tablet the ideal springboard for getting rid of paper.
The iPad, on the other hand, is imminently portable. It's a lot more durable than paper and binding. Of course, it's interactive.
So Apple today released iBooks Author, a new tool meant to lure publishers into creating new content specifically for the iPad education user. In a glitzy show at New York's Guggenheim Museum, Apple's Roger Rosner showed off the magic that makes it easier to include animation and lots of high-tech toys into textbooks and then publish them instantly.
And I just think that's totally awesome, right?
The crowd of publishers and tech gurus went wild. That's because the industry is hoping Apple's involvement will lead more businesses into what has been a relatively small pond. Forrester research analyst Sarah Rotman Epps says up till now, publishers have been mostly focused on adapting existing text to computers.
But they're not new content created specifically for the platform. That content exists also, but in much smaller numbers.
Apple's publishing tool is available today for free. The books that result from this effort will be sold in a new and improved iBook store. The company also announced upgrades to iTunes University, which already holds thousands of college lectures. Truth is, a lot of companies already offer some of the features Apple is rolling out, such as the ability to build flashcards or take notes digitally. Osman Rashid is founder of a startup called No, spelled K-N-O. Rashid says despite Apple's heft, the new initiative will help his business by making e-textbooks more common.
So we as a startup don't have to spend as many marketing dollars trying to educate the market. We can now spend our funds telling people why No is the best place to go.
At the same time, many in the industry think Apple's entry could prompt an industry shakeout. Apple's publishing initiative may also create a painful dilemma for school districts and colleges. Many students have been sharing iPads. That's harder to do when textbooks are involved. If schools want to jump onto this bandwagon, they will also have to buy a bunch of iPads at $500 a pop. Larry Abramson, NPR News, New York.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green, in for Steve Inskeep. In the war against piracy, there were some major attacks yesterday. The federal government shut down one of the Internet's largest file-sharing websites, Mega Upload, on charges of copyright infringement. And that spurred a group of hackers to claim their largest attack ever. The group that calls itself Anonymous says it shut down the websites of the FBI and the Justice Department for a while yesterday. Joining us to explain what's happening on the Internet is NPR's Laura Seidel. Laura, good morning.
Good morning.
So what exactly are these charges against this website, Mega Upload?
Well, first, let me explain what it does. Mega Upload is a site where people can upload large files, files that are too large to send via an email. And, you know, you can use this legitimately. Like, say, I wanted to send you a big audio file because I work at NPR. I could use it for that.
I could send you my wedding video and you could
exactly
upload it.
That is right. But what the Justice Department said is that for the most part, this site is not used legally. The people are trading all kinds of copyrighted material, movies, music, all that kind of stuff. And so they have gone and they have charged them with all kinds of pretty serious things, including, you know, criminal conspiracy, and they can face up to 20 years in prison. And the Justice Department actually coordinated with authorities in New Zealand and picked up four of the executives from the company in New Zealand.
Well, I saw the indictment is claiming that they were the 13th most popular site on the entire World Wide Web, which is a pretty big deal. And weren't they the site that Will.i.am from the Black Eyed Peas and Alicia Keys, I mean, they put out a video last month supporting them?
Yeah, here's where it gets really colorful. Yes, that's right. And the guy that they say is the CEO of this company, Swizz Beatz, he's a rapper, mm-hmm. and it's unclear if he's really CEO, but he's one of Jay-Z's producers. He's also married to Alicia Keys, and he's friendly with these people. And he said, hey, will you be in my video? And all these artists were in a video promoting Mega Upload. And then Universal actually sent a takedown notice and said, take down the video, and Mega Upload and Swizz Beatz, you know, fired back and said, we're not taking it down. We had the legal rights. So there was that spat going on. The founder of this company is a big guy who lived in a huge mansion in New Zealand. Apparently, they confiscated like $6 million worth of really expensive cars. He had a black Rolls Royce with a license plate that said God on it. It's quite a colorful story.
There's a lot of money tied up in this business. It sounds like.
Yes, there is. Apparently, he had made something like $42 million off of Mega Upload.
Well, soon after this indictment was revealed, we have these hackers who call themselves Anonymous, and they said they started attacking the DOJ and the FBI, I mean, government websites. What exactly did they do?
Well, what they did is, and just to make it clear, they didn't like go in and steal anything from the FBI, no secret documents. They essentially kind of shut down the site. So if you tried to go to the website, it would be slow or you couldn't get to the FBI website or the Justice Department website. This group has a history of doing this. It's a protest group that essentially is a group of hackers. And they were, for example, supporters of WikiLeaks. And when WikiLeaks released all those documents and from the State Department, Anonymous attacked people who attacked WikiLeaks, like PayPal shut down WikiLeaks account, and they attacked PayPal. So they have a history of doing this. And they essentially did this to the Justice Department because obviously they think Mega Upload is okay.
Well, on Wednesday, a lot of people know about Wikipedia, the website, going dark as part of the protest against this anti-piracy legislation. Is this all related?
No, and it isn't really. There is right now legislation pending in Congress that would, some people say, force websites to censor certain sites. And so they've been protesting this legislation. But it was not connected, other than both are about the government doing something about what Hollywood and the entertainment business says is a huge problem, which is theft of copyrighted material online.
All right, Laura, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It's NPR's Laura Seidel, speaking just from San Francisco.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Russia's Phobos Grunt spacecraft crashed into the Pacific Ocean on Sunday. It was a failed mission. It was meant to travel to the Martian moon Phobos and bring back a soil sample, but it got stuck in Earth orbit instead, never made it out of there. But in lieu of shooting off another expensive sample return mission to Mars, there is a cheaper way. Just wait for those Mars rocks to come to us. It happens once about every 50 years, and we got lucky last July when a meteor shower spit some Martian samples right here down to Earth. They fell way out on the Moroccan desert, but the samples have come back. Since then, scientists, including my next guest, have been snatching up those meteorites from meteorite dealers. Yeah, they exist. What do you do once you get your hands on them? Can you even touch one without contaminating it? Is there any hope those chunks might contain some trace of organic compounds or even traces of past or present life? Joining me now to talk about it is Chris Hurd. He's associate professor and meteorite expert at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Hurd.
Thanks very much.
You are actually in actual possession of one of these chunks?
Yes. I arranged to purchase a specimen of this amazing meteorite for the University of Alberta Meteorite Collection.
How do you buy one of these?
Well, you talk to a meteorite dealer, and you work out a good value, good rate, and then you come up with some money.
I'm picturing the scene from Casablanca in that marketplace where people are selling all kinds of stuff. Is there an underground meteorite market with folks who come in out of the desert picking this stuff up?
Well, in actual fact, in Morocco, there's a whole economy set up with people picking up meteorites from the desert. They know what they look like, and they bring them into the markets and sell them there.
What do they look like? What does the one that you have look like?
Well, it's kind of unusual as meteorites go because it is a rarer type, being from Mars. But it has a black, what's called a fusion crust, the outer crust that formed as it came screaming through the atmosphere, that sort of burnt look to it. And then on one side, it's broken, and you can see a bit of the interior. The interior is sort of a greenish-gray color.
So it's sort of glass encrusted in its own little delivery vehicle.
Yeah, that's right. The outside heats up enough to actually melt the rock, and then that forms a glass as it cools off after it comes into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And how do you analyze it without contaminating it? Now, because I'm figuring you're handling it. But you're saying since it's sort of covered in glass, the inside is sort of kept pristine from the way
it
was.
Yeah, well, that's something that we definitely want to test. How do you keep it from getting contaminated? That's probably one of the best questions, because this is a really incredible opportunity, being such a recent delivery, such a recent fall, that we want to try to do everything that we can to keep it from getting contaminated, including with organic molecules. And we have those on our fingers all the time, mm-hmm. and it's just the way we are. We have things like cholesterol and squalene, weird sounding compounds like that, that actually are in our finger grease. And so one of the things that I did after we received this sample was to actually just give a little bit of a rinse on the outside with a solvent that we're going to analyze that hopefully later this week or next week and see what we find. It's actually kind of a way of detecting whether anybody's touched it before it got sent to me.
And then how do you crack it open and look inside?
Well, then we're going to do everything we can before. There's a lot of sort of non-destructive, as you call it, tests that we can do first. But then once we're ready, we'll cut it open. We'll use a very thin blade saw, and we'll cut it open, and we'll look inside, and we'll make polished mounts that we can do various types of analyses on with microscopes. And just try to get as much information as we can out of it.
How old is it, and does it come from a period on Mars where life might have existed?
That we don't know at this point. All we can say is that based on the original work that was done by my colleagues, Tony Irving and Scott Keener at University of Washington, Seattle, we know that it has a texture. That is, the minerals, the way they're intergrown, is very similar to other types of Martian meteorites that we've looked at before. But we don't know anything about the age yet. Having said that, those other meteorites that this is similar to are in the sort of 200 to 500 million year old range. That's geologically fairly young, and that's not from a time period that where we think there was a lot of water around on Mars. But you never know.
Yeah, there was that famous meteorite from Mars that supposedly had signs of ancient life on it that created a lot of excitement and then went away very quickly.
That's right, and that one was is around 4 billion years old. So mm-hmm. that dates really from way back in Mars's history. As I say, we don't really know, because we only just started working on this, how old this particular meteorite is. But the potential is there, because it's a fresh meteorite fall. Because it's been kept pretty clean as far as we know, that once we get into the inside of it, we may be able to find, what we find inside is more likely to be from Mars than from the Earth.
Let's go to the phones. Dale in Denver. Hi, Dale.
Yes. I'd just like to make the comment that, ever since I first heard of these meteorites that supposedly come from Mars being found on Earth, I've been incredibly skeptical. The odds of an asteroid, a large meteorite slamming into Mars and knocking debris up and then having that stuff make it all the way to Earth are incredibly astronomical. Until we can actually get something from Mars and compare it to these meteorites, I think it's a little far-fetched making the claim that we're actually examining bits of Mars.
Right,
we have no proof of that.
Well, let me get a reaction, Dale. Thanks for that comment.
Sure, I can definitely address that. And there was a really seminal series of studies that were done in the early 1980s on a particular Martian meteorite, a particular meteorite that belonged to this group that was found in the Antarctic. Prior to that, prior to the mid-1970s, early 80s, these meteorites were kind of lumped into a group on their own. We didn't really know where they came from. We just knew that they looked different from other meteorites. In 1976, we had the Viking landers, and the Viking landers had instruments on board that could measure the composition of the Martian atmosphere. And they did that quite well. And in the early 1980s, this one meteorite was investigated and found to contain trapped gas inside of it. When that gas was analyzed, it was shown to be a match to what the Viking landers found in the Martian atmosphere. And further to that, it's been shown that the Martian atmosphere composition is unique in the solar system. There's no other planet or object or moon that has quite the same composition of atmosphere. So finding this trapped gas in the meteorite is a fingerprint that tells us that it comes from Mars.
Well, what can you learn from this meteorite or other meteorites that land in Morocco or other places, apart from what you can learn from the Antarctic ones that have already been discovered for many years?
Well, each one, they're all quite similar in some ways. They're all igneous rocks, that is, rocks that started their lives as a magma somewhere in the interior of Mars and came up and erupted near the surface. But they all have slight differences to them, and some of them are quite subtle. Some of them are even, you know, more subtle than what you see just by slicing it open and looking at the texture. And so these are the types of advanced studies that we do to try to figure out what this new meteorite can tell us that we haven't found in other ones. Every single one tells us another piece of the puzzle of Mars geology as a whole. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we can do is to actually peer back through the magma crystallizing into this rock. We can peer back and say something about the magma itself and the interior of Mars, that part of Mars that it came from. So in some ways, we can almost probe right into the inside of Mars through these kinds of studies.
Mm. Now, Dale from Colorado was very skeptical about, I mean, how could a meteorite, a piece of Mars, get here?
Well, he was right the idea is that some large object, some other meteorite, slammed into Mars and launched rocks off the surface. Mars is a smaller planet than the Earth. It has lower gravity, about one-third the gravity of the Earth. And it's been shown through modeling now that you can actually launch rocks off the surface of Mars. You don't even need a very large object hitting Mars in order to do it. The object that the minimum that you need is something that would hit Mars and make a crater about 3 kilometers across, which, you know, sounds kind of large, but there's lots of craters that size or larger on Mars. You can get a rock sitting near the surface, accelerated, you know, fast enough to leave Mars gravity.
And they could be floating around in the solar system for thousands of years.
Or millions.
Or millions, until something happens to nudge it in this direction or gets here?
It just happens to cross our orbit. And in fact, you know, the point about this is that because we keep getting this is now the fifth fall of a Martian meteorite, plus we found a whole bunch of other ones, some other 50-some other meteorites all over the world that have fallen in, you know, prehistoric times. We know that there's debris out there, Martian debris, sort of floating around the solar system, and it keeps landing on us.
So there could be a lot more stuff out there in the desert.
Oh, almost certainly, yes.
And are you going to be looking for more, or people? Is there competition to own this?
Oh, I'm sure there is. There's always competition. I'm sure there are groups out there looking right now. You know, the economy that exists around these things really drives people to, of course, go and look for more all the time.
What did you pay for this, if I might ask?
We paid $300 per gram.
And how many grams do you have?
58.
I'm doing a quick 60 times 300 is $18,000,
something like that.
Sounds pretty cheap to me for something that comes from Mars.
I have to say it's on the low end of what Martian and lunar meteorites tend to go for. They tend to be several hundred dollars per gram on up.
And so when can we see this? Will it be on exhibit or can we learn?
Well, there are a number of if any of your listeners get up to Edmonton in the next few years, we hope to have part of our piece that we purchased on display. But there are other groups making efforts to other collections, meteorite collections, purchasing other pieces. And the ones that are, I know for sure, Arizona State and New Mexico. So hopefully they have plans to show some specimens as well.
We have some photos on our website of this meteorite and other. We'll wait for other raiders of the lost meteorites.
Yeah.
Do you feel like Indiana Jones sometimes?
Sometimes.
Well, thank you very much. And we'll wait to see the publication of what you found there.
It's just the beginning right now.
All right. Chris Hurd is associate professor and meteorite expert at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. An American cancer patient became the second person in the world to receive a synthetic windpipe transplant. Surgeons in Sweden replaced the patient's cancerous windpipe with one that was grown in the laboratory. It was made from plastic nanofibers and seeded with the patient's stem cells. But just how was this artificial organ turned into a functioning airway? And how can this experimental procedure be used on other organs, perhaps lungs, even the heart in the future? My next guest, Dr. Paola Macchiarini, was the lead surgeon for both synthetic windpipe transplants. Dr. Macchiarini is the director of the Advanced Center for Translational Regenerative Medicine at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. Let's start at the beginning. How was the scaffold for the synthetic trachea built?
Well, basically, from the, by the same fibers that everybody of us has, in the sense of nanofibers, very, very small fibers that compose the native, the human trachea. So when we wanted to transplant this organ, we thought, what is best? And the best would be to just replicate what human nature has done. And this is the reason why we use these very thin fibers.
And then you seeded the fibers, the mold, so to speak, the plastic, with the patient's own stem cells.
Exactly, because this first step, the generation of the scaffold, was entirely made in the laboratory. But without the cells, this scaffold could not be implanted because the trachea is the only organ which is in contact with the external environment. So if you put a prosthesis or a synthetic material in contact, it becomes infected and you can have different lethal problems. By reseeding the scaffold with patient's own stem cells, we were making living a plastic tissue.
Did the stem cells then start to grow as trachea cells?
Well, when the first step is to produce a nano composite, then the second step is to take the stem cells of the patient. The third step is to put the two together using a so-called bioreactor, which is a shoebox where you put these liquid containing the cells and the scaffold. And the cells are attracted by this scaffold because it is biomaterial and permits attachment of the cells. And the cells are not only attaching, but then start to proliferate, are living, so that they feel like they would be in a physiological environment. Mm-hmm. Once you have done this, you implant this in the human body and you give bioactive molecules that differentiate the stem cells into the cells of the trachea. And this happens usually within 14 days after the transplantation.
And so that the stem cells basically grow and become part of the trachea.
Well, rather than growing, they differentiate into the given specific cells and avoid infection, death, and necrosis of the graft, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so by the time you transplant it back into the patient, you have the plastic structure and you have tracheal cells. that you're putting back into the patient?
Well, we have the nanocomposite. We have cells, but these are not trachea cells because in such a short time you cannot differentiate the cells. You just can have cells that are living, and once they are implanted, in the human body, we use the human body as a so-called own bioreactor, and we boost the regeneration.
And so, how long would it take for those cells to regenerate once they're back in the human?
Well, after 1 week of the transplantation, we did an endoscopy. That means evaluation of the graft, and by taking the cells out, we were finding evidence that the cells of the trachea inside it is were already there. So in as short as 7 days, you can have differentiated cells starting from not differentiated cells.
And how long would it take to cover and make a complete trachea?
Well, we did before the last patient came home, we did an endoscopy, and it was lined with the cells. And today we just drew with the pathologist that the cells were already there. So probably this depends as well on the three-dimensional measures of the trachea, because if it is a very long, it is a trachea with bifurcation, so that many factors play a role. But usually within 2 to 3 weeks, if you tell the body to boost, to accelerate regeneration, you can get a complete differentiated trachea.
2 to 3 weeks, you can make the whole trachea.
Well, wow. Using the human body as a bioreactor, yes.
So I imagine you could try to do this with other organs in the body, other things.
We are starting to learn what happens with this still experimental therapy. So I'm not so pessimistic to try to do the same with other tissues or organs. And since I'm a thoracic surgeon, I deal with organs of the chest. So I would think at the esophagus, at the chest wall, at the liver, at the lung, and eventually at the heart, yes.
And how are the patients doing?
Well, probably there was a huge media coverage when he came back in the United States, and he's doing very well. He was seen yesterday by his referring physician in Baltimore, and as far as I know, he's doing fine.
Can you reconstruct blood vessels this way?
Well, actually, the Yale University has started to a clinical trial approved by the FDA using tissue engineering vessels in children. So the answer would be yes.
Mm-hmm. And just to understand more completely, the trachea has a microfiber backbone to it, and on top of which you have permeated with stem cells, and the stem cells have been coaxed into becoming tracheal cells.
Exactly.
And then they have now totally covered and taken over on top of this structure of plastic. They have now become sort of a living organism?
Yes, sir.
Wow. And you did this all, it all happened within just a matter of a few weeks?
Well, usually, again, depending on the degree of difficulty of the three-dimensional aspect of the tissue, you can produce a trachea, for instance, just a tube in 2 days, and a bifurcated trachea in 10 days. So now, then you need 2 days for getting the cells receding the graft. So in 2 weeks, you have an entire trachea.
And perhaps you might extend your work further because you deal in this and possibly into the lungs.
Well, ideally, yes. But to me, my dream would be another one. Rather than replacing the lung or replacing the heart, to use cell therapy to treat these organs before they ultimately do not work anymore. So rather than doing a transplantation, just when we have the first signs of insufficiency, whether to treat these organs with the patient's stem cells, probably targeting the defect that they have, so prolonging and extending their life.
So if you have untreatable tumors, for example, within the patient, you might be able to, instead of putting a new part in, put the stem cells in, and they would grow into the to replace that.
Well, I don't think that this is so easy. We first need to be very cautious to identify so-called cancer stem cells, because within a solid cancer, you have cells that proliferate forever and have many of the aspects of undifferentiated and ever-proliferating stem cells. Mm-hmm. So whether we could target these cells to block the growth and eventually treat cancer, this is a very, very early.
So what makes your technique so revolutionary?
Well, the fact that, first of all, in 6 months we were able to treat two 31 and 30 years respectively young gentlemen that had an tumor of the trachea and are still alive. So the revolution is there, because there would be any other treatment options. And the second evolution is that to me is too much. But the new thing is that we saw in the blood of the patients stem cells that as soon as they, all three after transplant, were already expressing the profile of respiratory cells. So they were recruited from the peripheral blood and went home to the site of the transplant to make the cells of the trachea. So that means that indeed we could do and replicate this for other types of cells, like the liver, kidney, heart, or so we just need time and much more economic support to prove this concept.
Yes, time and money. That's all we need.
Exactly, as usually. Exactly.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Macchiarini, for for taking time to talk with us. Dr. Paolo Macchiarini is the director of the Advanced Center for Translational Regenerative Medicine at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. We're going to take a break. After the break, we're going to look at two renewable energy projects using pioneering technology, one that taps the heat that causes under volcanoes. Yeah, and another project to float wind turbines off the coast of Maine in really deep water, not close to the shore, but far away so you can't even see them from the shore, in deep water, creating, you know, electrical energy that way. We'll talk about it when we get back. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll be right back after this break.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. One of the biggest file-sharing sites on the Internet, Mega Upload, has been shut down. The Justice Department says the move is part of one of the largest criminal copyright cases it's ever brought. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, the case raises important questions for anyone who stores files of any kind online.
The reason the Justice Department spent 2 years investigating Mega Upload is because of people like Harry Dimwitty. You're stealing music.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm.
Dimwitty used to use Mega Upload to pirate music all the time, but not anymore. Yesterday, the Justice Department took down Mega Upload. Four of its executives were arrested in New Zealand. U.S. officials claim that hundreds of millions of dollars of copyrighted material, movies, music, TV shows, video games, computer programs, were being pirated using the same technology. Officials were tipped off to the problem by the Motion Picture Association of America, says Kevin Suh, who works on content protection for the association.
Mega Video and Mega Upload really are the worst copyright infringers on the Internet. And given that fact, it's important for us to use U.S. government resources to address this kind of problem.
And if Hollywood had been looking to cast a guy in the role of Internet pirate, no actor could play the role better than the founder of Mega Upload, Kim.com.
Awesome, man. 18 holds, man.
That is .com himself, from one of many online videos. In this one, he's driving a Mercedes right across the fairway of a golf course. In other pictures, he's with girls in bikinis standing by vats of cold champagne bottles or driving a yacht. .com was previously known as Kim Schmitz and Kim Tim Jim Vester, and in his native Germany, he was found guilty of insider trading and computer hacking. The Justice Department isn't giving interviews about the case, but in its 5-count indictment, it says .com and his executives are guilty of criminal copyright infringement, conspiracy to commit money laundering and racketeering. They face up to 20 years in prison. Jim Berger, a copyright attorney, says even if people were breaking the law on the site, that's not enough to convict these guys.
It's not just what people are doing on your website. It's that you, by actions and words, are inducing them to violate copyright law.
In the indictment, the Justice Department appears to have good evidence. For example, there are emails between company executives where they make it clear that they know they're profiting from copyright theft. But Berger also says the case raises some concerns as we move into an era where more and more people are storing movies, photos, music, and more on the internet, or as they say, in the cloud, like the kinds of services that Apple and Google have.
If you think about, you know, all the various cloud computing services, they can't monitor everything everybody stores on the site. It's just not really realistic to do that.
Mega Upload's technology also lets people store files in the cloud. Mega Upload claims that most users are like Katie Fishman, who use the site for legitimate reasons.
There are huge chunks of data that I have uploaded for my own use so that I'll be able to access them, whether or not I'm at my computer or someone else's or a work computer, if it's a question of multiple documents that I need to transfer and can't send over email.
Unfortunately, all the stuff that Fishman had stored up on Mega Upload is now inaccessible to her because the Justice Department took it down. Mega Upload user Dinwiddie says it's easy to just go someplace else to pirate.
You can go to RapidShare, you can go to file sharing. There's many other websites. Mega Upload was just the biggest name.
Indeed, many people may recall a long list of other pirate sites, beginning with Napster, onto Grokster, and so forth. Mega Upload may just be the latest model. Laura Seidel, NPR News.